Leroy Henderson, and I am in the process of conducting an interview for the Folklife Project on turpentining. I am interviewing Mr. Anthram Green, a native of Jacksonville, Florida, who lives at 3840 Division Street, and we are here in his home. Mr. Green, thank you for allowing me to come and interview you today. I want you to tell me your name, your age, and your birthday.
My name is Anthram L. Green. I live at 3840 Division Street, Jacksonville, Florida, 32209. I was born the year 1918, October 27th. My age today is 85.
Mr. Green, let's get right to it. When did you start working in the turpentine camps?
In the year 1935, I don't think I was quite old enough at that time, but it was then when I was induced to it by my father.
How old were you then?
I was 17.
What's your father's name?
Anthram Green.
When you went into the fields, did you know anything about turpentining? Had you learned anything from what your father had told you?
I didn't know anything but what he had told me and what he had shown me.
What were some of the things that your father did as a worker in the turpentine camp?
Well, he did some of all of it, including starting new crops, as they called it. New crops was done in the winter of the year, and the first crew that they had to go in, these were pine trees. I don't know exactly what size, but they were good size. They had a crew called the Blazers. They made a big blaze on right at the bottom of the tree. And in that blaze, another crew came with a broad axe to cut a slot to put a tin in that the gum would run on. And then there was a cup nailed and put under that tin. And this crop, this tree then was called a virgin crop. And they made a streak with a hack. A hack was a stock, about 2 feet, with a weight on the bottom of it, and the hack was a cutter that would cut. You had to chip with it, so the weight was to help him chip it, and he would make the mark like a V, the first mark, like so. And they hung the cup, and the gum would run into the cup. Now they had to cut what they call a streak like this every week. Every week they had to put a streak, and the gum ran down to the cup. This virgin would use until it would get at least 3 or 4 feet. You chipping boxes then.
What do you mean chipping boxes?
You would chip it to make this.
To make that V.
Right. And that was called a streak.
And that's where the gum ran from.
The gum ran from that, yes. Because you had to go through at least the sap so that the gum would run out. And it would run down to this tin into the cup. And whoever had it, these were called crops. And it may be 100, 200, no telling how many trees in the crop. Now he would have to, once a week, make a streak with the hack. He had to chip it this way. And you done that until it was raised higher. As it was raised higher, where it'd get up to here, then they would raise the cup and call it a yearling.
And at that time it was what, the 3-4 feet tall?
Yes, it began to get to be 3 to 4 feet. And they'd raise the cup up.
Why was it important that they cut the streak at an angle?
That would make it very easy for it to run down. And see, it become a face after it keeps going. So every time you chip, it made what they call a cat face. You keep going up, keep going up, keep going up.
Like whiskers on a cat.
Yes, sir, and it can, and the tar would keep running down. Now, I forget exactly how long it took for those cups to fill. And when those cups were full, then a crew that would call the dippers, they would come in and dip the tar. And they done it by the barrel. And back in those days, there was a very little bit they were getting per barrel to dip the gum. And whenever the barrel was full, each one would do so many barrels per day. If he was a good, strong man, he could do a lot of barrels a day. Now, a mule and wagon would all down in the rough pick up those barrels and put them out to where the trucks could get to them.
So these were roads that were cut into the pine woods so the mules and the wagons could get in?
Yeah, well, they made their trails. Even if it was a new crop, he still would have to make his new trails. And the wagon would go down into places where the trucks couldn't go. And then them barrels were loaded on that wagon and brought out up higher ground that the truck could pick it up. They had to use skids to roll the barrels up on the truck. Turpentine was a hard job. And now, I just told you about the yearling.
Yes, sir.
They were up about 4 feet maybe. And just a little above that, they stop chipping, and then they start to pull. It was called pulling boxes.
What do you mean when you say they were pulling boxes?
But pardon?
When you say they were pulling boxes, exactly what does that mean?
Pulling boxes were the same as chipping boxes. Now, chipping boxes was done with a hack that you had to chip like this to do this. And that's why the weight was on the stock to help you to chip it. Because when it got up high where you pulled and you're pulling boxes, you did that more or less by your weight of your body anyway, and you would pull.
You're cutting downward then, instead of at the angle like a cat's whiskers.
No, all of them was like this, pulling or chipping.
Okay. So everything stayed in a V shape.
Right. And that, you would see a cat face, say from, we'll say 12 feet from the ground, 12 inches from the ground, up at least, well, this is about 8 foot ceiling, near 8 foot before they stopped cutting that tree.
So a man had to be pretty strong to keep his hack up that high.
Well, no, the pull was a long stock.
Ah.
See, once you got up to where you had to pull, you didn't use the short stock no more. You had what they call a puller for the pull boxes. The lower ones was a hack, right, which you chip with, because you had to go it like this to chip to make that cut. It's called a streak. But when you get up to where you pull, then you had a long hammer, and you could reach up way on up. They didn't stop till you got about near 8 feet.
8 feet high.
That's right. And the tar would run down that face. It was called a cat face. The tar would run down to the, and you had to raise the cup up about halfway. And the tar would run to the cup, and when it was full, they'd dip it out. To dip, a man had to use a big can, but some call it buckets, but it was made from nail kegs. Finally, as things progressed, they started really making them in factories. They made them out of metal. But the first ones were made out of nail kegs. And they'd put a handle on it so you could carry it. And your leg helped you carry that heavy bucket. Now, once these barrels was hauled into the still, it was gone. A lot of people used to say tar, but it was gone. And I know about the still because the house that my father and I lived in was right across the street from the still. And the still, the process was the same as the way to make moonshine, the still. They would load this big kettle. And it was like a two-story outfit. Down below is where, it was like copper a copper tubing all the way around in a great big tub. And that was for it to run down through, but they had to cook it until the turpentine come all around through this big tub and come out down below where your stiller took care of filling the barrels with turpentine, raw turpentine. It'd been uncooked and cooked and cooked until when they do turn it out to run the tar out, it's rosin then. It's done been cooked. It's not gum anymore. It's rosin. It's real hot. They had open barrels to put that in. And so they would keep stilling the gum to make turpentine. They also was making rosin that came out of it. Rosin they could make glass, they could make rubber. Oh, I don't know how many different products they could make out of the rosin that come from the turpentine. There was another process when the wintertime came. As it get colder, the tar would stick on the face. So in the winter, they had to do what they call scraping. Now, this was hard. You had to scrape that off the face. And those cups would be full, and they'd dip them out into barrels. That also made turpentine. And they would scrape that. Now the face is clean. Now the tar can run down easier. And they lose a lot of it sticking on the face, so that's why they had to scrape it in the winter. They done their hanging also in the winter. And in springtime come, that's when your turpentine business started to really work. Yes, it was a hard job. They had what you call a wood rider. Usually he was white. He ride a horse. Now, he would ride the route just like you worked it. And he'd ride to see if you miss putting your streak on. If you missed any, he would let you know about it. The woods rider would.
When he let you know, how would he let you know?
Well, he would let you know where you know you missed rounding such and such a corner or this, that, and the other. He could tell you about where it was. And you knowing your crop, you knew the route already. Where, and if you missed any, he would let you know. He saw that you missed the streak. Because the new streak looked new. If you miss one, that one you missed looked older than the others. He know you had missed one. So that was his job, to ride the woods. They call him wood rider. And he would ride the woods to check to see if you had missed a streak on the tree. Some of the trees, according to the size, may have a face on each side of it, one on this side, one on this side. The tree, I couldn't tell the exact size, but they were pretty good size. It isn't hard to put it on a small tree. And so that would run on until the weather turned cold. And when the weather turned cold, that's when you done your scraping to get that tar, that would be distilled and made into turpentine. It was a hard job, and I believe it affected me being so young. I think that's what broke this arm. I didn't even know it was broke. And one Saturday, I went to a ball game. I had Sandlot baseball. I went to throw the ball. The ball got loose, and it come over where I was standing. I reached it, went to throw it, and when I threw it, this arm fell on back. Mm. Broke. And I'm sure that's what it was that called me at 17 years old, pulling boxes. So I only did it 17, about 3 years. Because in 1938, I had done some of everything to be done except pulling logs out of the woods. And so I know I needed to get public work. And I left and came to Jacksonville in 1938. And that got me away from turpentining. There were other things that we had to do during turpentining. In the winter, they done what you call raking pines. you had to rake about in a circle around each tree, rake the pine needles away from the tree, and each one, you got paid for so many that you rake per day.
How many could you do in a day?
Oh, gee, I forgot the number. Maybe 300 or 400, I don't
know. In a day?
Yeah, in a day. And you could, and each time you rake one, when you finished it, you had to either, you had yourself assigned a number, or you had some word. Some of them would have a word like top line. Some of them had a word like four. Or some of them might have a word like 15, whatever.
But your holler.
But yeah, somebody had to keep tabs of this to know how many you had raked. That was in order when the season come, when fires hit the woods, that if you had raked around, it wouldn't ruin that tree. So you done the raking in the winter. And you done your scraping in the winter, when you scrape the tar off the face. As I said, the face is called a cat face. Now, there were two tools that you used. The one that you chipped the boxes with when it was a virgin. You chipped boxes, it had never been cut before. When you chipped, you had a tool that called a hack. And the hack, you had to use to sharpen it, you had to use a cutter.
What's a cutter?
A cutter was a three-sided file, and they used on a grinding rock to grind that file sharp, and you could cut that cutter with it. And you also used a whetter, which was made shaped to fit that, to whet it after you had done cut it with your cutter. And then there was the puller. The puller had two sides to it. The hack only had one, because you hacked like this to make that cut. I showed
you. To make that V?
Yeah. You made the same V when you pull, but you pull that one like so. You go up and you get one, you go up and get the other, boom, boom, like that. That's where you cut. And that streak had to be there every week. Now, the fella who had the crop, he was going to get paid according to how many barrels was taken in out of his, that's what they call it, a crop.
Do you remember what a barrel would pay?
It's been so long until prices, I don't remember, because the little bit that I done, I could not, like dipping tar, I couldn't dip too many barrels. But I think we were getting something like 25 cents.
So what would the man that owned the crop get?
Well, the man that owned the crop was getting it all.
Mm-hmm.
In the figures, I wouldn't be able to tell you exact, but the man that was working was getting less than anybody. And also, and I meant to have that out, I wanted to show you how anyone that had a turpentine firm and the ones that we were working for. As a matter of fact, let me tell you this, the names was Gillis. And on my mother's side, my grandfather was a slave. And that's where the Gillis name came from, the Gillises. They had a quarters with little shacks. People lived in them. They had a sawmill where my daddy had worked at that. But that's not turpentine, and so we stick with turpentine.
That was in Soperton.
Trutland County. And the Gillises owned the biggest of Trutland County. So, let me see, I'm about to lose my train of thought. The quarters, all those people that worked for the Gillises lived in the quarters. They were little, two-room, maybe three. You know how to see one with three two-room houses. You lived in them. They had the commissary. That was a store. They carried about everything you would need. Because you ate a lot of white-back salt pork. You ate a lot of black-eyed peas. You ate a lot of rice. And then those that that when they killed hog, they would cure that meat, and they put that meat in the commissary. Now, you went, whatever you needed, you went to that commissary, and you bought it, and it was put on the book. They settle up with you every first Saturday. Every first Saturday, all of those people at work had to go in to be settled up. They would determine what you had made, and they would determine how much you might owe. If you got any money, you borrowed it from them. And at the end of the year, when you settle up, we'll say the first Saturday in December, he would determine whether or not you come out on top or you still owed him. And usually you still owed them.
It was just like sharecropping.
Yeah, yeah. Sharecropping was some similar, very similar.
Did people ever get cheated?
Yes. Yes, because...
Black people?
Yes, sir.
The workers?
But the workers. You take a sharecrop and you bring it up to where you lay it by. That's getting close to where you're going to harvest. And many times, the owner would find a reason to fall out with you. And many times he would run you off of his place. And you'd wind up losers. And he would get the spoils.
Same way in turpentine.
Well, turpentine was that you were just working for about nothing. Because you always was in debt to the man. If you wanted to leave, then another man that had a turpentine farm, if you went and saw him, then he would pay off what you owe this man, and you work for him.
And you go into the job owing money.
Right. You go in debt, you come out in debt.
Did your father work for the Gillises as well?
Yes, he did.
Okay. How did your family come to be in Soperton?
My family come to be in Soperton, as like I said, the Gillises had the Gillises plantation. I've got pictures of some of the big houses. I got pictures of a barn that's older than me. I never will forget that barn. We came to be in Soperton on my mother's side because my mother's father was a slave. He was a slave under the Gillises. And so they were given the name Gillis. So our family on my mother's side always has been recognized in Troupland County because we were Gillis. The old man that Neil Gillis, he was a judge in Troupland County. And that house still stands. That barn still stands. I always will remember it. I just took a picture of it last year. I got a picture of the commissary and a picture of the Neil Gillis' house. There was Neil Gillis, Rod Gillis, Murdoch Gillis. All three of them had a big house. And they owned a great portion of Troutland County. And when the economy went bad, back when they talked about when everything fell.
When the Depression came.
A lot of the whites that owned farms, they got them. So they owned the most of Troutland County, the Gillises. There's a highway run from Savannah, I believe, to Macon, called Jim Gillis Highway. That's 16. You ever traveled on 16?
Yes, sir.
I-16?
Yes, sir.
That's named after Jim Gillis.
Let me ask you, growing up on that plantation, when did your father come into the picture? Let's go back a little bit. Tell me about when your father came into the picture. Well, let's go back before that. Did your grandfather work in the turpentine fields?
I'm sure he did, but I didn't get to know him or my grandmother because they died when I was too little to know them.
So let's go to your father. What was his name again?
Anthrum.
He was Anthrum Green Sr.
Right.
When your father married your mother, what year was that? Do you recall?
Now, that I don't know.
Okay.
But I know that I was born 1918, and my oldest brother had to be He was only a few, I don't believe he's quite a year, might have been 11 months older than me.
And you all lived on the Gillis Plantation?
Yes, we did. My father came from Montezuma. That's up close to Fort Valley. He come from that area. But I never got a chance to know the people on my father's side. I just remember a couple of names or so that was his relatives. But he had to have started as a young man because he married my mother. And when I got big enough to know that he was my father, he was married to my mother. So what year? I don't know. But I happen to know that he come from wherever he come from, and he worked for those same people.
For the Gillis family?
Yes.
And he worked in the turpentine camps?
He worked in the turpentine camp. He done some farming. He done some of everything. As a matter of fact, he was the fireman for the boiler for the sawmill for them. He done some of all of it. They put a lot of dependence in him, my father.
What was it like living in the turpentine camp? What were the conditions?
Well, the conditions were very bad. You may have heard statements that those were the good old days. But see, we lived in these little shacks. And a lot of times they would situate a well. They used to dig big wells and dig them deep. And it wasn't a well at every house. People had to gather around to get their water or do their washing from that well. Now, if it was a big quarters, there may be two wells, but everybody had to get their water from that well.
Do you recall how many black families lived in the camp where you all lived? Was it a big camp?
Yeah, well, they didn't call it a camp. They called it the quarters, mm-hmm. Turpentine quarters. And any mail address and stuff was addressed to the Soperton Naval Store, which was owned by the Gillises.
When you remember that two-room shack, what do you remember most about it?
Well, what I remember most about it was that my father, due to the fact he was married to one of the Gillises, was able to live in a better house, though. Because now the house really that I grew up in was a big house. It was about three bedrooms in it, and the kitchen set off from the house. There was a walk, like a walkway running from the main house to the kitchen. And then, of course, you know, you had your smokehouse where you cured your meat. And you had your outhouse where you had to do whatever you had to do. Cold as it was, you had to go out there to that outhouse.
So because your father, Mr. Green, married a woman named Gillis.
Right.
Even though this was a black woman.
Yeah.
Because her name was Gillis.
Yeah.
You all had it a little bit better.
He did because
than other black people.
Right. He got good position. He got the position that he wanted usually.
What was life like in the quarters for other black people?
I have to, when you ask me that, I have to think about the people in whom we were working for. The Gillises were very, very good to their people. They didn't beat up on their people. Like the firm just below us, the Phillips Settlement, they beat them up. The Randolphs, they're around Swainsboro, they would beat up theirs. I know they beat them up because one time I went to work for old man Coleman at Swainsboro, and one weekend everybody was going to town, different places, and I had stayed home. And he come up and everybody was gone, nobody was working. And you know, unbeknownst to me, I didn't know he was going to attack me, and he did. He attacked me, other words, he hit me before I even know it.
Why?
Yep, and while I was right down, and I'm glad my wife didn't see it, she didn't see it. Then he wasn't going to shoot me, that was just to put scare. I didn't know he wouldn't shoot me, but he put
his
gun.
Why did he attack you?
because nobody was working, and I was the only one he found. And he attacked me. That was the last. That was getting close to the end of the season. When that season was done, I was gone. I didn't work for him no more.
And he put a gun on you?
Yeah, he threw the gun in my face, yeah. Black 38, blue steel.
What did you think?
I didn't know. I really didn't know. And he told me to get up and go out there and do my work and get to work in my field. And everybody was gone. I was the only one around. And some of those fellas don't know that today, that that happened to me. But when the season was done, I left there. So, yes, my father, by marrying one of the Gillises, got some better treatments than some of them. Even though the Gillises were not the type of people to beat up on their people, they didn't do that. They were others that the people really suffered. Because at some time a man could be sick, and he would have the little, he had his little foremen of all of the different departments, and they may go and roust him out of bed. I know one man died. He was sick. He had pneumonia. And they made him get up and go anyhow.
Do you recall anything like lynchings taking place back in those days?
Yes, but not in our company.
But it happened in other camps.
The Philip ones I told you about. They took a fella, beat him, they tied him to a tree, pine tree, and beat him to death and left him tied to that tree. Another one in that same settlement, this white fella was using his wife, and this fella got kind of drunked up and jumped on his wife, beat her up like Saturday. And that white fella met him down the road on Sunday, shot him dead right in the road by his own wife.
When did you meet your wife?
Well, that has to be the lady that's in the room here talking about my wife now. I didn't meet her until 1989.
Were you married before?
Yes.
Did you get married while you were in the turpentine camps?
No.
When you were in the turpentine camp, say in the quarters that belonged to the Gillises, what was it like for the little children growing up in that quarters?
Well, it was... I'm saying what it was like, that we were, I guess, under the conditions, we had been able to live and be satisfied of whatever state we were in. And we never went hungry. We ate a lot of common food, but we never went hungry. And we never had a whole lot of clothes. You had change of clothes, of course. But I know many days, like in the summer, I didn't wear no shoes.
What about when you got sick?
Well, when you got sick, whatever you needed that you had to get from your bosses, he put it on the book. If you needed a doctor, the doctor would come. Doctor would come to your house those days.
No going to the hospitals?
No. What if there was one, you wouldn't hardly be able to go in it.
What about going to school and getting an education?
We walked to school.
So you were able to go to school?
I have walked 6 miles one way to school. That was 12 miles round. We walked while the white children rode the bus and threw things after us as we walked along the road.
Did you know there was a difference in their school and your school?
We know that it was a school, and we knew that they had a better situation than we had. Because the school I went to was only 2 rooms to it. They went in a big school.
How did you heat that school in the wintertime?
With an old wood iron heater. I got a mark on my feet where one of the legs fell off, and I'm sitting close to it, my leg stretched out, and in that corner come down on my ankle. It didn't ruin my foot, but the scar is still there. In a 2-room school. You stayed there until you were ready for high school.
Where'd you get your teachers from?
The teachers come from most anywhere they could get them. and they had to stay with somebody in the area.
The bosses got the teachers.
Well, they had men they put in charge to see about getting the teachers.
Black men.
Yeah, and they would pay their way on the train or wherever they went to get them. I never will forget Miss Evelyn Beasley. That was my teacher. The first teacher I went to was my aunt, named Maggie, my mother's sister. She was teaching up in Adrian, Georgia. And that's where I went to school. My first year I went to school under my aunt. Little old, this was a one-room school. And it was just like the churches, the schools and the churches were all, you know, wood, no paint on them. Seats that was made by men who thought they could drive a nail. That's the way we come up.
What was church like?
Church was like church ought to be today. They had what they called circuit preachers, because he'd have more than one church. Because in our area, there were two churches in the area, the Methodist Church, Pendleton Spring, and Pendleton Spring Baptist Church. And if when service was at the Methodist Church, we went. When it was at the Baptist Church, we went, because neither one of them had church every Sunday. And at one point, we lived in a place where we were close to a school called, a church called Outlet Grove. But we stayed away from Phillips. You heard me mention that to another Phillips Chapel. We stayed away from that because those people would kill up blacks. They would hang them, yes. They would kill a man in a minute.
What did the children do for fun?
Well, we had our own way of playing. We made whatever we had to play with. We'd roll a car tire to death, or we'd get a hold of a wheel with an iron guider, and we could roll it. We could roll it for miles, just run along with that guider. And old tire, we may bat that for I don't know how far. And we played a lot of games, ring around or something, and we used to use the whip and the different kind of games we played among one another. We had a lot of fun with the way we played. We didn't have the things that we had now. And the clothes, I wore overhaul. You had the jacket, the overhauls, all that went together. And you had one, you kept specials, kept that iron and starched and iron. You wear that on the weekend. And through the week, your Brogan shoes you had. And to work in the woods, you had to wade a lot of water. There was what we call a branch, which was not a big river. We called it a branch. Then there was a creek. The creek was bigger, with deeper water. So we had all kinds of peculiar situations around us, but we were familiar with it. We knew, you know, just what would happen. Many times that we would, like on a Sunday, you know, we had chicken. Now and then you might get a piece of beef. You're lucky if you got a piece of beef. I don't know, there's many things maybe that I'm not saying that, you know, it slips me, and I thought I wrote down some of the things that I wanted to tell you about this fine stuff. We're going to tell you about the gum and the scraper. This stuff had gotten hard on the face, and you had a thing made just like the puller, only it was bigger, that you scraped that tar with, and it'd come right down and fall in the cup. And the dippers would come by and dip that out, and that went to the still also. And if you would see the still, it was a huge thing. The tub that I was talking about it would be in almost a diameter big around as this room almost. And it was made with copper that went like this, all the way right on up to the
coiled
top.
All the way
yes,
up
sir,
to the top.
Right. And when the boiler, when they poured the gum into it, it would take so many barrels, I don't know how many. When it was filled up, then they took this copper thing and then put on over the top of it, and they packed a wet clay around that keep it from, because you need to keep all the pressure in. Put that tar around it, and then they'd light up that furnace again. And it'd cook till it boils it, and it would boil until when you saw steam coming out down below, when you saw the steam coming out, pretty soon you'd see the turpentine start to come. And he had a great big funnel sitting in the barrel, and that ran, and he had to watch that. When that barrel get full, he'd plug it up, and all this was getting ready to haul off to Soperton. They had a big platform by Seaboard Railroad where they loaded all the turpentine. They loaded all the rosin. All that stuff was loaded on, and people who brought the cotton bring to that same place, that was loaded onto the train. Bale of cotton weighed 500 pounds. I forget how much a barrel weighed, turpentine or gum, but it was heavy. So they were people that didn't live as long as me. I'm 85 years old. They were a lot of young men didn't make it that long because they worked wading in the water in the winter with that heavy work, those barrels, rolling them up onto the trucks and all that heavy work.
It dipping, was really hard work.
Yeah, dipping tar. That was no easy job. And a lot of them died early, young.
What was life like for women in the quarters?
For women, it was rough. It was rough in the quarters.
What made it so rough?
Well, what made it so rough, yeah, you know how women are. They first of all, I learned a lot when I was a little fella. Those guys would be running with one another's wives, and I saw a woman get slashed good with a razor because the other one was running with her husband. All of that kind of stuff was going on. Now, there was some spiritual folks in it because they used to have rock on a Wednesday night. The rock, they would sing songs, hymns, and some of them would pray.
In the quarters.
In the quarters. They would do that on Wednesday nights. Now, it might be in our house tonight. Next Wednesday night, it would be at somebody else's house. It went round and round and round. And they would do that on Wednesday night. They called it a rock. But those people who believed in God, they would all be involved in these rocks.
What kind of jobs did the women have?
They kept the house. The man done the work. Now, the only job that they might have was that they'd go from the quarters to whatever farm where they would plant. They'd go to the field and drop corn or whatever they was planting. They could chop cotton. They could go hire themselves out for that. Because the steel was the steel. That was turpentine.
Did there be any women work in the turpentine fields?
No women in the fields. They didn't work in the woods, no. And let me tell you something about the woods. If I had a crop, I knew where I wanted to start my work. If I started pulling my boxes right here, I would run certain way I would go. And you'd be surprised that you very seldom run into any kind of a rattlesnake. But sometime I may take a notion to say, well, I'm going to start over here this time, come back this way. You're bound to run into him.
Why?
Well, he knew your regular route.
The snake did?
Yes, sir. But if you run it another way, you're subject to run into him. Because he knew how to stay out your way if you ran it the way you always run it. He knew how to stay out your way.
They wouldn't bother you if you didn't bother them?
No, if you got too close, it's bad. If you get too close to him now, he might strike you.
Did you ever know of men that got snake bit by rattlers?
Well, yes, I know of a couple. No more than a couple. Three. But neither one of them, it got to their skin. You know what? When you wear turpentine clothes, they're stiff. And the teeth, and one of them, his teeth got hung, and then he didn't get loose. And the guy jumped and run, so he was about dead when he stopped running. This is no joke. So... It was many things that you had to contend with in working in the woods.
What did the men do for fun?
Well, those that believed in worship service, they would like meet around one another's house and sit and talk the Bible or stuff like this. The others that didn't, if they were drinking moonshine, they got together and drank the moonshine, they shot dice, they done the gambling, and all that kind of thing.
Did they do that in the quarters, or were there special places that men would go to?
They would, like, if they were gambling or drinking, it would take place. Like, they butted, certain ones butted together, and you find them at the same place drinking moonshine. That's what they had, moonshine.
Were there juke joints around there?
No, we didn't know about no juke joint.
Really?
No, unless you went into town. And that was a little old place about 10 or 12 people and just loaded.
What kind of music did they have in the juke joint? Did they have people come in and play?
They had people who could play an organ, which you had to pump it with your feet. Later, they were able to have a piano, but way back, it was either a guy with a guitar or a harmonica.
And they'd come to the jukes and play?
Play. And now, if you had a dance, it was either at the school. And the school, if it had a platform, then he would come and play the music. And the guys, well, that's how most of us learned how to slow drag, behind guitar or harmonica music. And they knew how to play for you to dance. Now, my wife, she saw my hometown, and she could tell you how it was, but some of the old places began to fall down because later, turpentine, it's gone now, it's different now. They go and they cut onto it, but they put acid onto it to make it run the tar now.
Now, is the house that you grew up in still there?
No. No, but I know the exact spot. The chinaberry tree is still there, and I know where the house was.
I got a minute whooping with them chinaberry switches down in Mississippi
at
my grandma's house. Yes, I did.
Yeah, well, no, the house.
You're the only other person outside of my family that I ever heard mention
chinaberry tree.
Yes, right. It was right at the back door. And she reached out there and grabbed that thing.
Yes, sir.
It was glorious.
Well, it was, now, we had the house that we lived in.
Who built that house?
The Gillises had men that could build a house. They could cut the rafters and all.
Black men?
You had black men that couldn't read and write could build a house. They could build a house.
Because your house sounds special. If the kitchen was away from the living quarters, it sounds like a house that was made for white people.
Well, it probably was, because, see, when I come to know it, it was already there.
It was there.
Yeah, yeah. And the house that I was born in and raised up in was just down below the big house. Mm-hmm. That's why I told you about that barn and that big house. And I got pictures of both of them. If I had the minute to, I think I could find. I know where they are. But I wish you could see it. The old commissary is still there.
Is the turpentine quarter still there?
No, all of that has gone now.
No cabins?
They don't even distill the gum now.
Well, let me ask you, is the steel still there today?
The old steel, part of it is all about falling down, but I could tell the steel is still there. Because the old boiler, you can even see it, you know, because all the rest of the stuff done rotted away.
Any of the cabins that people lived in, they still there?
Very few of them. They all about fell down now. And because I remember the one that we lived in, the last house that we lived in that quarters, was right across from the steel. And that's gone.
Would you get up in the morning to go to work?
We had to get up 4 days in the morning. We say by time the sun was up, you should be on your job site. By the time the sun started to come up, you should be on the job site. So you had to get up way early in the morning if you were to get a piece of bread before you left to go to work.
How would you get there?
Many times walk.
How far?
Sometimes 6 or 7 miles to your crop. And you walk that far coming back. Now, if it was any farther than that, they might let you have a horse or a mule to ride to your job.
What time would you stop?
When the sun go down.
Do you remember the money that you made?
No, I don't remember the money I made because I never, well, up until I was 18, 17, 18, I never knew if my father even hired me out to anybody during the season when we were out of school. He collected the money. I'd done the work.
And he would hire you out?
Yes, sir. And
he might call any of the people that you worked for sometimes when he hired you out?
Yeah, he hired me out to one man named Ulma that had married into the Gillis family, and he had a farm. He hired me out, and I'd done that for him 2 different years. I knew how to do a farm when I was a little boy. I got here when I was 14 years old. I knew how to lay out the rows and everything else. Cotton rows were 2 feet, corn rows were 4. Now they just plant them close together now. And he would hire me out, and I'd be fortunate if I got 50 cents out of what I had made. He collected my money. My father did.
Was he a good man?
In some ways, I would say yes. He was a good man, but he was tough on us. He was tough. He was a man that made sure that his children done what was right, even though he might have done what was wrong. I would say yes, he was a good man. But I think he interfered with me a little bit too much.
How do you mean?
Well, there were some things happened family-wise that I don't care about going into it too much, but it was the very reason that as I was old enough that I left Soperton walking about midnight. And I think I had 35 cents in my pocket. And my father and mother had separated. He had interfered with me quite a bit. And I couldn't take it no longer because it had gotten bitter. And he had done some things to me, and I wanted to hurt him, and I knew it was wrong. And the only thing I knew to do was to get away from it. And I left there walking, and my mother was in Vidalia. They were separated, and I had to stay with him. And he was going to rule my life, and I was dissatisfied with what he did to my mother. So the first time that I got it, told him about himself, he was on to me about a young lady that I had been bothering with. She had gotten pregnant, and it was two of us involved, but he wanted to make sure it was me. And so I got a daughter when I was a teenager. And but I never raised that daughter because I wasn't with the girl. But he had quite a bit to do with that. As a matter of fact, he jumped on me and beat me up pretty good behind that situation. And I'm working together, pulling boxes with him. I didn't intend to tell this. I hope you don't publicize this either.
I won't.
And he beat up on me, and we were still pulling boxes together. And on Friday, we got to a point in the crop where we reshot them up your tools to move on to the latter part, last part of the. But while we were sharpening our tools, I was on the one stump, he was on the log sharpening his. And I wanted to take that puller, catch it in his neck, and just pull it. That's how salty I was, because I was still sore in my head where he beat me in my head. So that Sunday night, I made up my mind, and I left.
Did you ever go back?
No.
Was that your last day in the fields?
Yes, sir. That was in 1937.
Where did you go from there?
I came to Jacksonville.
Why Jacksonville?
I don't know. I just wanted to get away from there. I said, I'm going to Florida, and I wound up in Jacksonville.
How'd you get here?
I left there.
You left walking at midnight?
I left walking. I walked all the way to Vidalia.
You walked from Soperton to Vidalia?
Yeah, that ain't too old. It's a long way, yeah. But anyway, I told my mother what had happened, and I wasn't going to stay because I knew he was going to be looking for me. And I'm going to keep going. And I left Vidalia on US 1, and a fella come along in a truck and picked me up. And lo and behold, it was another man with a turpentine firm down below Vidalia, Spellman. His name was Spellman. And when I got in the back of the truck, I found a quarter, so that made me have, what, 60 cents or whatever it was.
That's big money.
I told him I was going, and I told him, I was traveling. And when he got to where he, just before we got to where he turned off to go to his firm, and he asked me, would I like to work for him? And I told him, well, I wanted to keep going. And I made a deal with him. I worked for you a week. And he agreed with it and took me into his place. He was a turpentine firm.
What did he pay you?
I think he paid me, I believe it was 75 cents a day. I think it was 75 cents a day he gave. And I was working in the woods with some men. And put me in the house with a lady that was a spiritual lady. She had one son. Put me in a house to live with her. And that lady talked to me like a mother.
How old were you?
I was 17.
17 years old.
Sir.
On your own?
Yeah. And she talked to me like I was her son. But I kept my word now, and he kept his. I worked for him that week. He paid me and took me out to the highway to a convenience store where the bus stopped. And I got the bus and come to Jacksonville. Been in this area ever since.
Ever since?
Yeah, ever since. But anyway, term timing was tough, and I feel like I was put into it too early. And as a matter of fact, even though I scuffled to finish high school, I finished it right here. I was just a little ways from finishing high school. I finished it at Stanton High here. And the man that helped me out, let me work for him a week, give me his address. If I got where I needed it, if I got in touch with me, he'd send for me, bring me back. But I wasn't going to go back in there.
How did you make it in Jacksonville? You didn't know anybody here?
Nope.
You had no family here?
Yeah, well, I met a fella while I worked for this man that week. He was up there visiting his parents and told me he was from Jacksonville and gave me his address. And when I got off, I went and found him. And he helped me to find a place to stay temporarily.
At 17?
Yeah. And I went out here in Myrtle Avenue in this town, and there was the farmer's market. And there's where all the trucks would come in from these different farms with loads of stuff. And I would help unload these trucks. And an old white fellow was seeing me. And he kept watching me. And every day he'd come and get all those leaves that fall off the greens and all of that. He would feed it to his hogs. And he asked me if I would like to work for him. I told him, yeah, I need a job. So it was over in Arlington here. It's still Jacksonville suburb, but it was in Arlington. And I went to work for him, but I can appreciate him. He was white, old man Idaho. He was a moonshine man, but I didn't know that. But what I like about it, and I think about it this day, that he and his wife did not introduce me to that. I went to work around his house, the little garden and stuff, but he never put me into that. And I'm thankful for that today. I worked there with him until I began to need a better job. And he even looked out for me in getting another job. And I'm very thankful. God been with me all along.
When you look back on turpentining from the time you went in to your last day, what did it teach you?
Well, it taught me that the one thing it did teach me that I was to earn whatever I received. In other words, if I worked for you, I needed to give you a day's work for a day's pay. That stayed with me. It stayed with me even till this day. That if I work for you, I need to give you a day's work. You give me a day's pay.
Did you ever see a time on the Gillis plantation and the Gillis's quarters where black men were able to become overseers and foremen, the woods riders?
No. I never seen a foreman or a woods rider. The highest job I seen any man have was to be a sawyer. My father was a fireman at the sawmill one time. I never seen a foreman white. Now there would be some, I don't know what you would call them, but when we would be hanging boxes, new, when I told you about, we started the virgins, there was a man named Mr. Joe Bryant that would pay attention to trees that maybe the fella who cut the first strip, what I told you he was, I may didn't write it on here, but they were the people who would cut the first face on that tree. And sometime, the guy who cut the tree, he hold a big broad axe. He hold it there, and the other fella hit it with a maul, wood maul. He carried it on his shoulder. He only hit it by once, boom, and that would cut the thing to put the tin. Now, if somebody missed doing what they were supposed to, Joe Bryant, if he spot that tree, he would hit on it with a, you could hear him hit on it with a big, he had a big limb he used. Wham, 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 you had to come back and do that tree.
And you could hear that?
You could hear that whipping on that tree, yes. Because he'd be fairly close to you. He wouldn't
Joe
let you.
Joe Bryant was the overseer.
No, he wasn't the overseer. He was the man to check to see to it that you got all the trees.
Was he a black man?
Yeah, he was a black man.
So that's a pretty good job.
Yeah, that's a pretty good job, yeah. Joe Bryant. But the rest of them had to get it.
Everybody else had to go get it. Huh?
Yeah, and I was a 10 tacker, and I could tack them too. There was two of us there that nobody could beat us tacking 10. No, sir. A boy named Howard McKeever and myself, we both were tacking 10s. Now, you had another with stick 10s. Now, he would take the 10 with a little wood mallet and tip it into that gash that had been cut. The next fella that would do something with it would be the one to put the first streak on it. And the next one come by the cup and a nail, and he hang the cup under that tin.
And you were tacking tin?
I was tacking tin.
And what does that mean?
That was to keep that tin in place. If you didn't nail, if you didn't tack it with little small nails, if you didn't tack it, it would come out of place and your tar wouldn't get in the cup. It would run on the ground. So they had to put that tin in there that it would see, it would slant like that.
Yes, sir.
The cup's on it here like this, and the tar run off of that tin into the cup.
So you were part of a crew?
Yes.
How many men were in your crew?
Well, let's see, you had the maul, the man with the axe and the maul, that's two men. Then you had the one that was going to put the tin in the slot. He was one. The one that was going there, see, there were two sets of them with the maul and the axe. He had the same amount of people. He had somebody coming, sticking the tin in, one come by that's nailing the tin, and the one come by to put the cup and then big nail in the cup. And that's 2, 3, 4, 5. There's five in each one of those crews. And then, now the rest of them was people who kept you supplied with the stuff you needed. You had to holler that when you get down, when my tin was getting my nails or anything like that, I would holler for nails or whatever, and they would bring it. And you had to keep steady nailing those
when
tins.
When it got cold or when it got too hot, you still had to do what you still had
keep
to do.
Keep going. Sometimes it would be cold, and sometimes you had to wade through some water. You may either have on boots or some didn't have on boots. But as soon as you come to, now you weren't gonna get to stop until noontime, but there'd be a big fire then and you'd stand by, you know, your clothes get kind of dry from where you've been wading the water. Sometimes your water be gushing out your shoes, you know, when you were working in the woods I had rheumatism when I was a young fella working in the woods.
Was there singing in the woods?
Singing?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yeah, that was what kept you moving.
What kind of songs would y'all sing?
Oh, let's see. Some of them would sing the blues. Let me see, what was it?
Did you have a favorite?
No, I never done no singing myself. I listened to the other. Let me see, what is it? One guy sang one that called me the fat man because I know my way around. I forget how many others, but they would sing. Some of them would sing a spiritual song, you know.
What's your favorite song?
Pass Me Not, O Gentle Savior.
Would you sing a little bit of it for me?
Pass me not, ain't got no voice. O gentle Savior, hear my humble cry. While on earth, then thou art calling. Do not pass me by, Savior, Savior, hear my humble cry. While on earth and thou art calling, do not pass me by. That was one of mine.
Oh, Mr. Gray.
I love that song.
I sure do. Thank you.